Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees, so our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future as we reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali, and today we'll talk about elections in the Ivory Coast, Tanzania, and Guinea. Joining us are two distinguished guests, Chipo Dendere, Assistant Professor for Africana Studies at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. And joining us from New York is David Monda, Professor at the City University of New York. Chipo and David, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're
most welcome. Now, Chipo, being the first time that you are coming on the show, talk to us about your impression of elections in general on the African continent. When you look at the democratic trajectory, what is your impression so far?
I think it's easy to feel dejected and to think that the democracy project is suffering. But over the years, I think what we've seen is that there are more elections across the continent, that there is more demand for space from different groups, particularly the young people. We haven't seen as much turnover as we would like. So we continue to see, you know, the same political parties winning elections, the same candidates winning. And so that's definitely a detriment and a concern. But I do think that especially the young people, because the continent is very young, they are creating opportunities for themselves and they continue to demand change and to demand space. So that's hopeful. That gives me a sense of, okay, if people keep at it, then democracy is not nearly in as much danger as one might think. I think the problem comes when people say, you know what, we're going to give up. We're going to stop fighting for our rights. We're going to stop fighting for what we believe in. But as long as people have the energy and the will to keep fighting, then democracy has a chance. But of course, with the three elections that we're here to discuss, there is definitely some concern that there's, you know, the increased use of violence in the Tanzanian election, the fact that we've got presidents seeking extra terms and trying to protect themselves to entrench authoritarianism. Those are all issues that are taking the continent back. Even as some countries are making progress, very soon we'll be looking at the election in Ghana. But then you have these examples of taking us backward, especially the recent election in Tanzania. I had not anticipated that level of regression.
What about you, David?
I think I would be a little more cautious because I think we've seen some very alarming signs in terms of democratic backsliding and deconsolidation. And specifically in relation to the fact that, Shaka, we have a lot of these elections, which are really not elections. They are selections. And they are choreographed around this very cheeky framework of people voting. It appears that there's some form of ballot counting, but the result is a foregone conclusion. Secondly, the opposition parties are harassed, they are intimidated, opposition candidates are assassinated or severely injured, like what happened with Tindi Lissu in Tanzania. And we also have the third element, Shaka, of leaders basically extending their terms in office, which used to happen during the Cold War, but during that era, leaders just used to do it anyway because they could play the East off against the West. in the modern day, in 2020, the new African strongman is manipulating the constitution in a way that it extends their rule of power, even though it appears on paper that there are elections. But this is, again, is another selection. And we see this in terms of addition of time under constitutions in Ivory Coast and in Guinea. But we also see it in terms of Tanzania, and specifically in terms of the authoritarian nature of the Magufuli regime, that he so consolidated and concentrated power within himself and within the Chama cha Mapinduzi that now there's even fear that in another 5 years, Magufuli could decide to amend the constitution the way Conde has done and the way Ouattara has done in Ivory Coast to extend his term in Tanzania. So I am extremely cautious and concerned about the fate of democracy on the continent, in particular context in these three countries.
Monda, you raise a very interesting question. You refer to the individuals who happen to be at the top of the political harem in their countries as leaders, and yet we all know, frankly, that for you to be a leader, you have to be in a position where you must consult your people before making very important decisions that affect them. Is it possible that perhaps we are using a wrong name for people that would otherwise be referred to as rulers? And I'm talking about especially those individuals that engage in the business of the shifting of the political constitutional goalposts, simply, in fact, for political and perhaps personal reasons rather than national reasons.
Yes, I think you could call them rulers, but specifically in relation to the context of how they rule. When we think of leaders, we think of individuals having a following. And actually, the idea that you actually follow a legitimate constitutional path. So I guess you could call them rulers in the context that the mandate from the electorate is not certain. And there's a lot of repression and fear and intimidation, not only of the opposition, but also of the electorate. And we see this in Guinea. We see this in Ivory Coast, and unfortunately also we see this in Tanzania. So, yes, I guess you could also call them rulers in this context.
Chipo, you said a while ago that you seem to be impressed with the democratic trajectory in the sense that at least as far as the politics on the African continent are concerned, we do regularly conduct what some pundits refer to as regular elections, as opposed to quality elections. Are you satisfied with the idea of merely conducting regular elections after every 5 years? Or should we perhaps be looking, frankly, at serious elections that are, in fact, qualitative types of, you know, elections that at the end of the day produce a result that is a reflection of the will of the people, but not really a result that is the will of the individual who announces the results or the will of the individuals who count the votes?
So I think for me, there are a number of things that are happening, and I like what David called that they're not elections, they're selections. But I think we can break it all down to different aspects, right? So they are the rulers slash leaders, and they are the candidates, whether opposition or ruling party. They are the electoral commissions, then they are the people. So for me, I think when I think about democracy really on the continent, my focus is always on, well, not always, but I think it's important to see what's happening with the people, right? So what we're having on the continent is that we've seen, you know, this shift from the Cold War where now the leaders are playing jiu-jitsu, if you will, with the constitutions. trying to use the rule of law to consolidate authoritarianism. So that's one thing that's happening, which David alluded to. But at the same time, we've got real grassroots movements that are happening on the level of the people, right? So the reason why we know what's happening in Tanzania, what's happening in Ivory Coast, what's happening in Guinea-Bissau, what's happening in Zimbabwe right now has to do with civil society and the citizens. And so for me, that's where I see a lot of opportunity. Granted that the people are facing challenges where people, you know, the governments are using the military or the police to restrict people. But even within that, we continue to see civil society pushing and making space for themselves. Now, the other alternative would be to say, well, elections are not free and fair. Elections are rigged in favor of the leaders. The leaders are going to continue manipulating, and we stop having elections altogether. But if we do that, I think we miss opportunities that are there. So once in a while, we find that when civil society is engaged, when citizens are engaged, even under the most difficult circumstances, the people can prevail. And so for me, that's what I like to see. I mean, we saw in Sudan just the last year, we saw the people's movement push for change. Now, we can debate all day long on whether or not that was good change. But even in Zimbabwe, which is where I'm from, and we've continued to see challenges, what we know now is that because people's voices are continuing to express themselves, even if the regime tries to restrict people, they can't silence everybody. And that's what's happening in Tanzania right now, that the regime is trying to silence the opposition, but they were forced to release because people spoke out. And so when I think about democracy, I'm often thinking about the individual citizens. How are they viewing the situation and how are they responding to the situation? Then, of course, ideally, we want a democracy that is substantive, where elections are peaceful, where the results are reflective of the people's will. But I always say this about democracy and elections, that inherently democracy is a very violent process, whether we agree with that or not, right? We are asking people who've been saying really nasty things about each other to have a civil form of engagement. And ideally, this process of the ballot should diminish some of that nastiness that's embedded in the competition of politics. But on the continent, you know, we have a long way to go in that, because, you know, part of it is that I think our leaders, not just the ones at the top, but the MPs and the people that are involved in the electoral processes, they are too dependent on those positions. They're afraid to leave. They're afraid of what becomes of themselves when they're no longer tied to those positions. So I think part of the democracy project has to also be about thinking about the economy in the broader sense. Would it make a difference on the continent if we had more people in the middle class, if we had people that are more comfortable financially? Would that change the type of person that runs for office, who can risk their lives to enter politics? Would it change the way that the average citizen is going to engage with politics? So I think there's a lot to say, but I still remain optimistic, because I think when we think about the average person, right, the people are the reason why we're having these conversations, because they're going out, they're participating, they aren't giving up, even though they should, because this process has been very difficult and very brutal for many people, but people aren't giving up.
By the way, Chipo, you mentioned Guinea-Bissau. We are, in fact, looking at Guinea-Conakry, the country that belonged to the great man, the late Sekou Touré.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Now, talk to me about the issue of democracy. Democracy is defined, at least here in the West, by what I first learned in primary six, Kigezi High School in southwestern Uganda, in Kabale, according to Abraham Lincoln, democracy is a government of the people, by the people, for the people. How do you respond to some people who say that the kind of democracy we are experiencing across most of Africa, not in every African country, but across most of it, is, in their words, not mine, a government of some people, by some people, for some people.
And they're not wrong. I think there are very few countries where the average person might feel that the government represents them, might feel that the government is working for them. I know, you know, my colleague here is from Kenya, and I've been following the conversations in the Kenyan parliament, where sometimes people feel that people enter politics so that they can line their pockets. And I think this is a theme that would reverberate across the continent, where people feel that the politicians enter so that they can make themselves rich and so the government becomes just for a small sect. But, you know, I think they are, and part of that reason really is because we have so much poverty across the continent, where the average person is just focused on their everyday existence. And so politics feels very removed from them. And so we would not want in any way to undermine that truth. But I still go back to saying that even though that is the case, even though some politicians might feel that they own the government, they own the country and everything that's within it, I think it's important for us as scholars of democracy to constantly remind people that these countries are in fact theirs, and that this democracy is in fact for the people, and that it belongs to the people. And it's important that we remind people as a way of empowering them and saying, look, it doesn't matter that you feel, oh, you know, I am not wealthy enough to be engaged. But we must continue to claim our stake. And for me, I think that's the message that I think is really important, that we must continue to claim our stake. I see in Uganda, Bobi Wine was arrested recently. And one of the things that he said, or maybe it was somebody using his account when they came out, was that we don't stop claiming what belongs to the people because a few people have made it their own. We must not stop. Because one of the things that, you know, I think Africans haven't pushed our politicians to do is to say, look, our continent remains one of the wealthiest continents on earth when we think about our natural resources. And yet when it comes to election time, we are not pushing our candidates to be open in how they will redistribute resources, you know. And so we sit back during election time and we let these people make policies and promises that are not reflective of the will of the people. But we must continue to push them. It would be easy, I think, for us to sit here and say, oh, you know, democracy has failed in Africa, because you see that too. You see people saying that the type of Western democracy that has existed has no place in the African context. And my pushback on that is, well, what form of government then would be ideal for Africa? And I haven't seen an answer to that that's very satisfactory. If not democracy, then what?
Very interesting. David, you know as well as I do that some democratically challenged rulers on the continent sometimes actually go to the extent of saying democracy is an alien ideology, that it is something that belongs to the Mzungu. Even though, frankly, when you look at democracy, it essentially reflects values that you would actually regard as universal. When you talk about justice, when you talk about fairness, when you talk about compromise, these are, when you talk about fairness, these are universal values. One does not need really to have a PhD in political science to understand that that is democracy. Is it possible that perhaps we should move away from the semantics of using democracy and probably talk about social, economic, political justice for all?
I think that the two items are not mutually exclusive. I think you can't talk about economic and social justice for all without talking about democracy. And neither can you talk about democracy without talking about economic justice for all. So I think it's very important to reemphasize democracy as a conduit to have some of these social and economic enfranchisements within any society. And in relation to what my colleague Chipu had mentioned, this is very true. There has been significant growth and support in terms of expanding the democratic space, and also significant economic growth generally on the continent. It's the region, I believe, before COVID, Africa was the region expanding at the fastest rate globally from year to year until COVID hit, of course. But then we have now come into a certain space, Shaka, where, for example, with COVID-19, a lot of these authoritarian regimes have used COVID-19 as a pretext to clamp down on the opposition, on political gatherings, on the activities of civil societies, and also in the context of the elections in Guinea, in Ivory Coast, and in Tanzania. We saw the government restricting or clamping down on opposition rallies due to COVID, but a lot of the government rallies were being allowed. So there's this duality in terms of favoritism. And then the other element, Shaka, we also need to be thinking about when we're thinking of democracy in the continent and how it then can advance socioeconomic growth is this idea of the individual context of each country. I think we should remember in Tanzania, they had this very unique case where Zanzibar, which is actually a federated union with Tanganyika to form Tanzania, feels very marginalized from last election. So this election, there's been an inconclusive element of a referendum. The central government in Dodoma has refused to allow the people of Zanzibar to have a plebiscite to decide whether they want to be part of the union or whether they do not. And then secondly, is the other very challenging issue with democratization that Chipu had alluded to in the context of Tanzania. Because here you see essentially a one-party authoritarian regime where it really seems that since the days of Nyerere till 2020, till today, the Chama cha Mapinduzi is entrenched not only in the civil society within the political space, but also within the military. And it's almost impossible to see a scenario where should Magufuli decide he wants to leave and the next candidate is picked or selected and presented to the electorate, you find it very difficult to see how the opposition would in any way be able to challenge this individual. And then thinking also about Guinea, thinking about the Ivory Coast. The irony with the Ivory Coast is that Alisson Ouattara had lived in the United States for many years. He knows how democracies work with the Bretton Woods institutions for many years.
And has a PhD to boot, by the way, from the University of Pennsylvania, an Ivy League.
Correct. So he was with the IMF for many years. And a lot of what he's learned in the West, his democratic values that you'd assume he learned from University of Pennsylvania, are just not being articulated on the ground. So I am again very concerned. I'm not skeptical, but I guess I'm more concerned about the future for democracy on the continent in terms of Alpha Conde in Guinea, in terms of Ouattara in the Ivory Coast, and also in terms of Magufuli. I really feel we need to start creating a space, as Chipu had mentioned, within civic society to have an alternative to some of these leaders. Because if you look at the context of those three countries we've talked about, and even a lot of other African countries more broadly, the players in the political game almost inevitably seem to be the same individuals year in, year out. There's no turnover. Magufuli has been years in the CCM. You think of Mnangagwa with ZANU-PF, you think of Alpha Conde in Guinea, you think of Ouattara with the era of the Hufe Boigny's. Where is the new generation? And when we have these elections, Shaka, we keep regurgitating the same old leaders. We don't really offer new faces, whether it's in the opposition or even in government. It seems like we keep rehashing the same old faces, whether in opposition or in government. And I think that's also something, in addition to the context of the country, that we need to be thinking about. How do we get more new faces, more young people, more new ideas that are outside of the ruling party or of some of the dominant opposition players?
And, you know, can I just jump in there, David, because you mentioned something about Tanzania that I've been thinking quite a bit about. When I was doing my my PhD research back in 2013, I spent quite some time in Arusha. And for me, one of the first things that jumped out to me is that Arusha at the time was governed locally by the opposition. And the mayor was from the opposition party. And, you know, so him and I, we would drive around. And he would mention that the CCM, they had their biggest hold in all of these rural areas. And back then, it was under President Kikwete. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was very exciting, although I think Magufuli has slowly done away with that, is that the opposition had come up with a strategy to begin to get into local elections. So I think that sometimes the issue with African politics, right, is that the focus is always national. Even when I think about people like, you know, Alison, who's gone back to run for office in Ivory Coast, when I think about the president who got into Gambia, the guy from who was in the UK, I forget, the current Gambian president, I'm forgetting his name, which I blame on being a new mom. We have a newborn, and I feel like, you know, since having her, my brain is all over the place. But so one of the things that struck me with all of these people is, why aren't they starting off at the local level? Because that's where the challenge is, really, right? We talk about, well, where's the young leadership? And I think you've got these people that are really wonderful, but they seem to just fly in and want to start at the top. So, and they're not assisting in building grassroots level from the bottom going up. So I think it's really important for anybody who seeks to be president to start at the local level and to build a very strong grassroots movement that's focused on the councils, that's focused on the provincial elections, the municipality elections. Because if they do that, and that's one thing that, you know, Morgan Tsvangirai had done very well, but, you know, the story ends very differently with this passing on. But I think what the MDC had done in Zimbabwe was to infiltrate ZANU-PF strongholds at the local level. And even if the ruling party keeps winning at the national level, in some cases, you get good policies because you have enough opposition parliamentarians in government.
As I often say, time is not our best ally. We'll go for a short break, and when we return, we'll continue with the discussion. So please, don't go away.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. And today we are discussing the elections in the Ivory Coast, Tanzania, and Guinea. And my distinguished guests are Chipo Dendere, Assistant Professor for Africana Studies at Wellesley College in Massachusetts, and David Monda, Professor at the City University of New York. Talked about Tanzania. I also did part of my PhD dissertation for UCLA research in Tanzania. 1985. I spent 6 months at the Chuo Kikuu, University of Dar es Salaam, and the Tanzania Film Company. I spent 6 months in Tanzania, and it was obvious from what I saw and what I experienced that the ruling party, Chama cha Mapinduzi, the revolutionary party, which, by the way, sometimes the locals jokingly refer to it as chukua chako mapema. Get your share, cut and run. That has obviously implications for corruption and what have you, because it is the only game in town. You are talking about a situation, by the way, where if there is any aspect of democracy in the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi party, it must be at the top within the party, because no single individual has wanted or tried or attempted to stay at the top for more than 10 years. Every 10 years, an individual finishes the two terms, passes the baton to a comrade. But when it comes to the party itself, and come to the country itself, there is no evidence to suggest that we are looking at a country where there is separation, of the ruling party and the state. It would seem to me that, in fact, there is incontrovertible evidence to indicate that, in fact, the two are fused. And if the two are fused, then how can you even talk about political space? You have a party that controls the security forces. You have a party that controls the treasury. The only thing perhaps that it does not control really is the oxygen.
Yeah, Shaka, I think that's an interesting point. And I know you don't want to digress on the issues of decentralization, but I think that's also another important imperative when we think about decentralization. For one, a lot of these constitutions are structured in a very unitary framework. So power is concentrated in the national capital in many cases. But again, going back to Tanzania, it's extremely difficult to move away from a heritage of rural farmers who only know one game in town, the CCM. How do you even start, even if the CCM gives you the space to campaign in the rural areas? There's intimidation, harassment, and there's manipulation of provincial administration and local leaders to harass, the opposition candidates. But then also in terms of some of our two Francophone countries, Guinea and Ivory Coast, I think part of the other legacy with the challenge in those two countries has been the interference of France in the democratic process in those countries for many years, particularly in the Cold War, and the strong influence of France even still today, which is very different from the tradition of the Anglophone countries, in this case, Tanzania. So in Guinea and in Ivory Coast, we'd remember how the French would intervene militarily at their own behest, at the invite of any of their patrons in Francophone Africa. Their rapid deployment forces would come in and would overturn whatever challenge came to their patron in, whether it was Abidjan or if it was in Guinea. And I think this is creating, in particular in Ivory Coast, Chaka, a very dangerous precedent, because now the country is lingering on the brink of civil war. Opposition candidates, about 40 of them, were denied access to the ballot. Some of Ouattara's strongest challengers were denied access to actually come on the ballot. And now we see more of the military coming in to support Alison Ouattara, and also in Guinea, we had the military come on the streets to break down some of the demonstrations against Lusana Conte. So it's a really, really troubling period in terms of democratization. And I think this is, again, an area post-COVID that we really need to think about how to re-energize that civic society base that that Chipo was talking about, to broaden the space. Because I think in addition to the problems with COVID-19, these authoritarians have used this pandemic to break down civil society and to also break down the opposition. And I think this is a theme we'll keep having in the elections that are upcoming in Uganda pretty soon and probably in Kenya in the next couple of years.
David, we should point out, by the way, that the leader in Guinea-Conakry is Alpha Conde.
Yes, okay. My apologies, yes.
Alpha Conde, thank you. When you talk about French influence in Francophone Africa, yes. But when you look at history, it really wasn't in Guinea-Conakry, especially because the founding president of Guinea-Conakry, Sekou Touré, was the only individual that said no to a sort of French Commonwealth that had actually been suggested by the French president, General Charles de Gaulle. You remember? To the extent that, in fact, Guinea was the second indigenous African country to regain her political independence after Ghana, which had gotten its independence in 1957. But that does not really change anything much, because when you think about the manner in which those countries hold elections, and a lot of other countries on the continent, there are very few countries that have gotten it. Ghana is one of them. You have countries like Benin, you have Senegal, you have countries like South Africa, you have countries like the Seychelles. They only recently, after 43 years of one party in power, the opposition actually won an election. You have several countries in Southern Africa which have embraced the concept of democracy. You have a lot of other countries in West Africa, certainly not so many in Central Africa, not so many in East Africa, not so many in North Africa. What do you think, in your view, needed to be done, needed to happen, so that African countries sincerely can begin to hold elections that are for the benefit of the primary stakeholder, their people, and not for example, their development partners, the donor community?
Alpha Conde, I was just looking up some things about him, and I think he's 87 years old this year, 87 or 82.
82. I actually had the dubious privilege of having dinner with him last year here in Washington.
Well, why did he want to run again, did he say?
It's just like other few of his colleagues on the continent, when they actually want to hang on to power, what they tell you is essentially that they are, quote-unquote, succumbing to the pressure of their people.
That it is the people that want them, and therefore they stay in power for a long time. You know, I think David raises an important point that COVID has caused some further restrictions, and that we're going to see more authoritarianism because of COVID and leaders using that as an excuse. But to any question about the fact that there is no separation of the state from the military, there's no separation of the state. But I also think it goes back to that the presidents, the executive, they control everything and they control the money.
Right.
And it's so because the ruling party, you only get access to resources when you are in the ruling party. So everybody wants to be in the ruling party. In Zimbabwe recently, saw a member of the ruling party try to leave the country with about 6 kgs of gold. Because you're in the ruling party, you have access to natural resources, right? You can just go up and dig. So I think
Chipo, if I might interject in, do not forget that when we are talking about who controls the state, controls everything almost, in fact, including oxygen, because the state in those situations happens to be the single largest employer and the single largest contractor.
And so when I think about this, I think, because, you know, one of the candidates we're talking about is from the diaspora, and I was just looking up, my own other work looks at the remittances that are sent to African countries. The three of us here, I'm sure we understand what it means to be sending remittances. In Kenya, the data that I just saw for yesterday say that this year alone, there have been about $6 billion that's been remitted back to Kenya. The numbers are just as high in Francophone African countries. The numbers are high in Zimbabwe and other countries. And so I think there is an opportunity for the diaspora to collectively use the remittances as a bargaining point for democracy. Because I think at the end of the day, finances do matter, right? So how finances are distributed, taxation matters. And if citizens and countries don't feel safe to speak up for themselves, I think that the diaspora is in a unique place to mobilize. And we saw that in the Gambia, right? When the ouster of President Jammeh, there was a lot of credit that was given to the work that was done by the diaspora and the mobilization, the support for civil society, the support for voters, right? Creating opportunities for people to securely submit their vote. So there is a whole other constituency that we don't engage enough, which is the diaspora. And the diaspora has a role to play in all of these elections that might mitigate some of the challenges that locals are facing. Now, most countries don't allow diaspora voting, but quite a number of countries have now moved towards allowing diaspora voting. Ghana, Kenya, I'm not sure. I don't think Uganda has diaspora voting, but huge diaspora population. And so the diaspora should be using their voices in effective ways, I think, to push for more democratization back home.
What about the issue of the international community stepping in? You know as well as I do, for example, that Africa used to attract many military coups. That is no longer the case. And the reason is very simple. Because coups sort of run out of vogue simply because the international community is no longer willing to do business as usual with a sergeant or a colonel or a general who shoots his way with an AK-47 to power. Why doesn't the international community also adopt a policy that says if you actually hold an election and there is incontrovertible evidence that you have rigged or storing that election in order to stay in power, the international community is no longer going to do business as usual with you. That if you also, for example, engage in the business of the shifting of political constitutional goalposts for your personal and political interests, the international community is no longer going to continue doing business with you. Don't you really think that would work as a sort of political detente?
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical on that one, Shaka. And I say that because let's not forget a lot of these major powers and former colonial powers have interest in the status quo. So Guinea, Ivory Coast, Tanzania, Kenya, Zimbabwe, Uganda, they were not created for the benefit of the people in those countries. They were really centers of extraction for the British and the French in whichever these regions were. So right to this day, a lot of these former colonial powers and major powers have their interests, which are not always in sync with the narrative of democratization, especially when the candidate who looks like they're about to win an election is not particularly favored by some of his major powers. And we saw it with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And there's a whole litany of these cases. I would propose, piggybacking on what Chipu had mentioned, to re-engage the civic society, civil society groups in particular, and with a particular emphasis of enabling them to generate resources locally and to entrench their legitimacy locally. Because part of our problem has been civil society is they are too dependent on foreign donations, which really raises questions about their authenticity and their credibility. In other words, who's really the calling the shots here? So even locally, that's something I think we should really be thinking about. And I'd also like to make one more point on what Chipu had mentioned about diasporans. This is something we've been interrogating recently, you know, in relation to Eastern Africa. And I think one of the challenges with the diasporans, why we're not as engaged, is one, we're very divided because a lot of the divisions that are on the continent get transplanted in North America or Europe, right? Whether it's Shona Ndebele cleavages, whether it's Kikuyu Luo in Kenya, whether it's Fulani, you know, Fulani or Yoruba Hausa, Igbo with the Nigerians, whether it's Burkinabe versus Bole in, you know, Ivory Coast. And to re-engage the diaspora is challenging in that regard, but also in regards to the fact that Chipu, when I send money to my mom or to my auntie, the government, yes, takes a percentage of that, but it's difficult to disengage the remittances for survivalists, for consumption from the political narrative. It's really a tricky one, because how do you tell a Zimbabwean not to send money back home to their struggling uncle or auntie who needs life-saving medication because they're upset with the Mnangagwa regime because he's getting 15% of that remittance? So I think part of the strategy needs to be reconfigured around, if it's remittances, in terms of how then do we create an economic muscle for these remittances. And I would move more, Shaka, within the angle of how are diaspora groups organizing here, for example, in the context of Ivory Coast, to really hold Alassane Ouattara accountable. What I would be interested in seeing is diaspora communities in North America putting pressure on the IMF very directly to hold them accountable. This was your man in New York. This was your man in Washington. And look at what he's doing in our country. His policies, his governance is not conducive to economic and social justice, the long-term economic and social justice for Ivorians. I think for diasporans, these are some of the narratives we should be interrogating. How do you, example, hold Alassane Ouattara accountable by putting pressure on those donors in the West, whom he knows on first-name basis, to really put his feet to the fire and say, what you're doing in Ivory Coast is not right. Alpha Conde, what you're doing in Guinea-Conakry is not appropriate. And to Magufuli, what you're doing with the CCM in Tanzania, your denial of the COVID virus, your repression of your people is unacceptable.
You know, you remind me of a statement, you know, associated with a professor, Henry Kissinger, who once said that politics is religion. And of course, I'm also equally reminded of the classic work of a professor, Hans Morgenthau, who in his book of Politics Among Nations talks about how countries have neither permanent allies nor permanent adversaries. What they have is permanent interests. And so when interests basically change, the alliances keep shifting. You said already that the international community would not be that sort of democratic referee precisely because it has its own selfish interests.
Mm-hmm.
I am reminded here again by my friend, Ghanaian and Pan-Africanist, Professor George Aite, who actually said that part of the reason Africa is where it is, not serving its people, is simply because at independence, Africa inherited the same colonial vehicle and only changed the drivers. That in fact what Africa should have done, and probably if it is not too late, should do, is essentially become creative, innovative, and create its own vehicle rather than changing the drivers. How do you respond to that, Chipo?
You know, I think I like Professor Aite. I like his work. I like to follow him. I do think that sometimes he tends to want us to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, and he has reasons to think that way. But before I respond to that, just to come back to what you said about international intervention, in Zimbabwe with the last coup, the thing that I would learn later is that the embassies in Harare were all very engaged. I think, you know, this is the first time that Americans were sort of neutral and stood back. But the British, the representative for England, I had a chance to meet with them. And I learned two things from that meeting. The first is that our international partners, they don't respect us. That was number one. Number two, it was
why don't they respect us? Isn't it perhaps because we do not respect ourselves?
No, absolutely not. I think they were in my presence and they kept repeating things to me that the opposition is a joke because the person leading the opposition is young. And so their view of young Africans, at least in the Zimbabwean context, was that we don't have the chops to lead ourselves. And so because of that, the position from the British consulate at the time was that they should align with ZANU-PF. And they were taking a lot of pride in having facilitated the coup. And it really came down to complete disrespect of what Zimbabweans want and a complete disrespect of young Zimbabweans. And in my pushback, I say, you see this young man, Nelson Chamisa, whom you speak of like this, if he was a young British, a young white elite British, you would say that he is innovative. You would say that his ideas are bright and they are smart. But when he talks about building a country that is based on technology in Zimbabwe, you look at him and you say he's ridiculous. Because in your mind, as young Africans, we're not capable of seeing beyond our role as puppets, really, to the West. That our role as Africa be to produce the raw material that builds wealth for the Western world, and that we are not capable of innovation. So, you know, prior to that meeting, I had been really convinced that our relationship with Western countries could be useful. But I think it's not just about respecting ourselves, but it is really about realizing that the world is based on interests that have nothing to do with our development.
I see what you mean, and in fact, you remind me of reading a book about builders of the empire. When you think about those young British who built the British Empire, which presided over territory where the sun never set. When you talk, for example, about Sir John Cecil Rhodes, the man, unfortunately for you, whose territory that was supposed to be Zimbabwe was named after him, Rhodesia. He was an incredibly young man.
He was.
When you look at Dr. David Livingstone, these were incredibly young men. If those people could do it, what about our own young men and women?
Yeah, Shaka, this is a good question, but I would push back on your lionization of Rhodes and Livingstone, because in a large part of the continent, these were the purveyors of the tyranny and roots of exploitation of our continent. Think of Rhodes in Rhodesia, his vision of the Cape to Cairo Imperial Empire. These were the men and women who established pure, naked, mercantilist exploitation of the continent, whose structures, by the way, are still in place today. Kenyan tea is produced raw and packaged and sold at a fortune, and the benefit goes, the branding goes to England, not to Kenya. Cocoa from Ivory Coast, and so on.
Maybe I didn't make myself understood, or you misunderstood what I meant.
Yes.
In a sense, I meant to say that those young British men, whatever they were doing, was in the service of promoting the British Empire, essentially at the expense of those of us who called Africa home.
I think this is an interesting narrative that we really need to unpack and develop on the continent. This emphasis of global norms around human rights, around corporate governance, around good governance on the continent. And I think this is something that is very much needed in Guinea, very much needed in Ivory Coast, and also very much needed in Tanzania. We cannot have a system where major powers only emphasize their interests, because it always comes back to bite them when they ignore situations in Somalia or Afghanistan or some of the so-called failed states, the weaker countries.
I have confidence and hope in the changing demographics on the African continent in tandem with their social media, because their social media empowers them enormously. It brings information to their fingertips. They are the sort of generation that is more exposed than any other generation before it. Chipo and David, I have to say frankly once again that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have had the opportunity to have this incredible, incredible conversation. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, please remember to keep the African hopes alive.